Part 2. Chapter 5. The End of the World. When I saw that thing emerge over the stadium walls, back into the streets of Tucson, I knew we were fucked. I was done. We were done. And by we, I mean everybody. You, me, everybody. So I gave up. I know that's probably not what you want to hear, but that's what I did. I gave up. Just because I'm the narrator here doesn't make me a fucking hero. I was done. All I cared about in that moment was Nif, and she was either dead or trapped forever. I knew it to be true. So I backed up the truck and aimed it homeward. Took a long time to drive home, navigating around the disabled and destroyed vehicles that littered the street like crumbs. Even when I got to the part of the city the monster hadn't yet touched, it was still bad. People running away, or goddamn running towards the thing. I watched in the rearview mirror of Scooter's truck as the monstrosity rampaged through the south side of town, near the airport and the Air Force base. Unable to bear anymore, I moved the mirror and turned off the radio. It was almost 10 o'clock by the time I got home. The rain had stopped, and the clouds dispersed to reveal a hazy sky lit by the half-moon and the fires of the burning city. I didn't have my house keys, but I got in through the side window. Inside, the first thing I did was open up Hamlet's cage and set him free. The ferret bounded outside. We lived near the edge of town, and I knew he'd be safer out there than in the house. I grabbed a beer from the refrigerator, and I sat down on the couch. I waited to die. When I was a kid, my dad moved us all over the country, following jobs and ridiculous dreams and whatever else struck his fancy. We ended up in West Virginia for a while when I was 10 years old. We lived in a rickety-clackety trailer on the property behind a plantation-style house next to deep, fairy tale woods that spread for miles and miles. With no other kids nearby to play with and a whole summer before me, I spent my days exploring. I was a regular Mowgli for a while, swinging from trees and venturing through endless forest. The only other human I talked to was the old lady who lived in the main house. She fed me pot pies in her living room while she obsessively watched QVC. Sometimes it would rain for days straight, and I'd run outside in nothing but my underwear and a pair of scuba goggles. I'd stick my face in the raging creek behind the house and look for frogs and box turtles. I'd almost been swept away 100 times, but it was fun for me, and my parents never noticed I was gone. After the storms, temporary ponds formed in the deep woods, lasting 2 or 3 weeks until they dried up. I would spend hours playing with these ponds, building dams, digging holes to connect them, or just splashing around in them with my Power Rangers. After one particularly long storm, I found a large rain pond about 2 miles into the woods. It was filled with blobby frog egg sacs. I visited it every day until the sacs hatched, releasing thousands of teeny tiny tadpoles into the shrinking pond. Once I saw the tadpoles swimming around, I started to worry. How long would it take them to grow legs and hop away? I knew if it didn't rain soon, the pond would dry up and they would die. I wanted to move them to the creek. For that, I would need a bucket.
You can't do that,
the old lady said when I told her.
You'll either hurt them trying to get them into the bucket or they'll die in the creek. It moves way too fast for such small creatures. That's why Mama Frog laid her eggs in that little pond. It's best to leave it be and let nature take its course.
I didn't want to leave it be. The closest regular water supply was that small stream just beyond our house, almost 2 miles away from the tadpoles. All the other rain ponds had dried up. Every day I filled 2 water jugs with water, trekked the long path to the tadpole pond, and refilled it to keep them alive. I fought a losing battle. Some days I'd make the trip 2 or 3 times, 2 miles each way. Every day, despite my replenishing of the pond, it got smaller and smaller. I prayed for rain. The clouds came, the sky rumbled, but it didn't rain. One Saturday, my dad woke me early and told me we were going fishing. I'd been asking him for a year to take me, so I was excited to go. We never went fishing that day. We went to my dad's job site and spent the morning collecting hunks of metal. Then we drove 50 miles to a place where my dad argued with a man over how much he'd sell it to him for. Eventually, they agreed on a price, and my dad and the man went to a bar together. I was left alone in the truck until it was dark. And when my dad finally came out, he sat in the cab, put the keys in the ignition, and passed out. It had been a hot day, but it was a cold night, and I spent it shivering in the back of the truck under a blanket that smelled like oil and dog. I looked up at the dark and cloudy sky and prayed to God that it would rain, even if it meant me getting wet. Still, it didn't rain. I didn't make it back to the pond until Sunday afternoon. I lugged 3 water jugs out into the woods. It was so hard to carry them. I had to stop every few hundred feet to rest, and the trip took twice as long as it usually did. I got there too late. The tadpoles were dead. The pond had dried up in the heat. It was my fault. I sat in the leaves, staring at the black, still muddy hole filled with the dead tadpoles. I could smell the green, mossy water, but it was all gone. It felt as if an elephant stood on my chest, crushing me. I wasn't even sure why I was so upset. I thought frogs were cool and all, but I didn't love them. Why did I care so much? I think it was that I felt responsible for them. I had made the choice to take care of them, and even though I'd tried my best, I had failed them. I fashioned a small cross out of some twigs and stuffed it in the depression made by the pond. When I got home, the door was locked and my parents weren't home. As I waited, it started to rain. I know. As ridiculous and ironic as that sounds, that's what happened. It rained. The old lady saw me outside in the downpour and let me in the big house. She microwaved a pot pie for me and, as usual, QVC blared on the TV. I sat at her table, soaking wet, stewing with anger. At first, I had just been sad. I had prayed for rain, and it came. But it came late.
"I hate God,"
I said. Startled, the old lady looked at me for a long time and then said,
"Why is that, huh?"
So I told her. Only when it came out, I didn't stop at the frogs. I kept talking. I hated God because of the father he had given me, the father who never kept a promise but continued to make them. I hated God because I continued to believe everything my dad said. I hated God for giving me a quiet wallflower of a mother whom I hardly knew and who hardly knew me. I was half Filipino on her side, and I didn't know anything about myself or where I came from, and she never cared enough to share. The old lady laughed, surprising me.
"Your parents love you. I can tell. They're just not good at showing it. You have to learn to take care of yourself, and that's all there is to it."
She stood and took the now cold pot pie out of the microwave and plopped it down in front of me. It was the first time I had ever said anything to anybody about how my parents treated me. Her answer wasn't earth-shattering or profound. Years later, I'd realize it was just an empty answer an uncomfortable adult gave a child when she didn't know what to say. She spent a few minutes watching me eat. Then she continued.
"As for your frogs, goodness me, Adam, the Lord doesn't care about the beasts of this world. They have no souls. Their purpose here is to keep us alive and humble and happy. These tadpoles you tried to save, it was noble, but God wouldn't answer such a prayer. God doesn't see them. He doesn't care if they live or die. How could he? If he did care, why'd he put the puddle there? That would make him unkind, would it not? No, he put them there to teach you a lesson. Maybe a cruel lesson, but it'll serve a purpose sometime in your life. When you care for something, I mean really care for something, it requires sacrifice to do it proper. Now, I don't know what sort of sacrifice you needed to make to save them tadpoles, but it was more than you were willing to give.
It was a deeper answer than what she had said about my folks. I wasn't sure I understood it, but it sounded important. It seemed like she wasn't talking just about the tadpoles, either. Like she had given me a puzzle to put together with pieces that didn't fit. Either way, her answer made me feel like shit. I couldn't stop thinking about that conversation now as I sat on my couch, mourning Niff. I grabbed one of my Rubik's cubes off the table and I worked it without even looking. I did that often, when I needed to think. I owned over 20 of the cubic puzzles. One was always within reach, every room of the house, at work, and in the car. Some people chewed on their fingernails. I solved Rubik's cubes, though it wasn't a challenge anymore once I learned how to work it. My keychain even held a mini cube, a present from Niff. I didn't like that one much, but I would never tell Niff. I could solve any 3x3 cube in under a minute. My record was about 15 seconds, though I'd gotten lucky that time. Outside, my neighbors talked in the street. One of them had a radio, and they listened and cried. Some drove off, screeching into the night, while others talked about it being safer here. Above, aircraft and helicopters streaked by. They were too late. The Grinder was now a full-fledged Tokyo-destroying behemoth. It crawled into Arizona Stadium, a centipede, a giant monster. It lurched out, a mountain-sized destroyer of hope and faith. We had power at the house, but out my window, the majority of the city looked dark. Fires burned everywhere. I turned on the television. Nothing but static. I don't know how long I sat and stared at the gray snow. My body felt numb, but my mind churned. I knew where I was, but I was so lost. It hurt just to look away from the static and think about anything at all. A distant explosion rocked the house, knocking a framed and autographed picture of Pee-wee Herman off the wall. The glass shattered when it hit the floor. It was Niff's, and she prized it. A moment later, the power faltered, but it came back. I stood and picked up the broken frame, and I stared at the inscription. Jennifer, I know you are, but what am I? Pee-wee Herman. That's my name. Don't wear it out. I never liked Pee-wee Herman much, but Niff loved him. He had been at some celebrity-filled fundraising event she attended as a little girl. That's when she got the picture. She said he was the only one who was nice to her. I clutched the broken frame. The corner of the picture had bent and torn in the fall. Glass had scattered everywhere. When she sees this, I thought, she'll be pissed. That did it. I cried. I cried like a damn baby, bawling and wiping snot on my sleeve. I felt ashamed. I had abandoned her. I thought of the guy driving the tractor that had failed to bring the monster down. At least he had tried something. I didn't know who he was, but I bet he had a loved one caught up in the beast. The phone rang. Great. It was probably someone I didn't want to talk to. Maybe Niff's aunt, Cece's mom. I let it ring out. A minute later, it rang again. I sighed. She had to be terrified, not knowing what had happened, where her daughter was. She deserved the truth, as horrible as it would be to tell her. I picked up the phone and stared at the number on the caller ID. The phone clattered to the floor before I realized I had dropped it. It wasn't Cece's mom. It was Niff's cell.